Vienna, welcome.
Thank you, Paulina. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. So you published a book called The Origins of You, which I have right here. Can you start by defining and telling us what an origin wound is?
Yeah. So when I sat down to write the book, I was trying to figure out like, what are all of the different wounds that we as humans could possibly have? I'm a marriage and family therapist. I work with individuals, couples, and families, and really look at how we grew up, the family systems that we were a part of. And so when I was thinking like, what are the wounds that we can all experience? I came up with five: worthiness, belonging, prioritization, trust, and safety. And for me, it was looking at the first times where there's a rupture around our worth, around our belonging, around our prioritization, right? How important we are to the important people in our lives. The first time there's a rupture in trust, there's the first time there's a rupture in safety. So when I say origin wound, right, I'm talking about that first experience that shifts the trajectory around the way that we see ourselves, the way that we see each other, the way that we see the world at large. And, you know, a lot of people sometimes are like, oh, I can't think that far back, or I don't have those memories. You know, sometimes an origin wound will happen in the early years. Sometimes an origin wound might happen when we're a teenager. It might happen when we're in our 20s. It might be something that happened a few years ago or a few weeks ago. But the first time we experience something that really changes the trajectory of our relationship with those five things.
That's interesting. And could it be that we both have the same or similar experience, but for you, it's more of an origin wound, and for me, it's not something else's? Could that be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's really important that we don't actually try to force ourselves into a box, or you see yourself in somebody's story and you're like, ah, but that's not how I internalized it. So for example, if a parent left, you were abandoned by a parent, you know, in your life, one person might internalize that as a worthiness wound. Okay, the parent left because I wasn't good enough for them to stick around. Somebody else might internalize that as a trust wound, for example. Ah, you left and now I can't trust the most important people in my life to be dependable, to be stable, to be consistent, right? So it's very important that you realize like, no, you don't fit into a box. You know, this language was a framework that I used because I was writing a book.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you like a different word, go for it. You know, if you're like, oh, this, you know, an abandonment wound, or I would describe it this way, beautiful. But I used these five words because I think it did really encompass the human experience. And it felt like a really beautiful framework from which to explore this topic. But yes, it's how each individual person internalizes it. What's the story you tell yourself, right? The story that you create about the experience that just happened.
Yeah, that's fascinating. There's so many facets to this that we could go down. But so as I was reading your book, I thought about this really interesting example. Before my great-grandmother passed away, I interviewed her specifically about her life, but mostly I was interested in she spent 53 years married to my great-grandfather. And they met when she was 18. They got married very quickly. And so she told me something interesting that I didn't know. She was like, your great-grandfather grew up in a family. He was the oldest son, and he had younger siblings who were all girls, younger sisters. So his dad was an alcoholic, so he became kind of like the protector of the family. He was very protective of his sisters when his dad would lose his temper. And she was like, you know, that was great in his childhood because he was very protective. But then in our relationship, that kind of morphed into possessiveness or jealousy in some situations because he was now protective of his wife. Have you seen how something positive in certain situations or in your childhood could then morph into something negative in your personal relationships later in life?
Yeah. And it's interesting, right? Because you and I, we could probably argue here whether or not that actually was
a positive
experience for him, you know, right? Where it's like, you know, there's an asset, right? There's a skill set. And I think it's a really important important thing that you're bringing up, because our gifts and our pain are often next door neighbors. A colleague of mine said, yeah, our wounds and our gifts, right? They're next door neighbors, right? This idea that, you know, all of us, so many of our greatest assets, right, come from our need to survive something from before. Right? You have people always say to me, well, I wouldn't be who I am today without the story, right? And it's like, you're right. You know, it's absolutely true, accurate, valid. And also so much of our stories are driven through survival. So when we think of your great grandpa, right, it's like that was a trait of his that was birthed from needing to survive a family system with an alcoholic father who might have been, okay, unpredictable, or anger. He had a temper, or, you know, we didn't know which version of our dad we were going to get. I'm making some things up.
Yeah, so we
don't know exactly what the experience was, right? But it's like, okay, so he developed this asset, this skill set, right, where he was very protective, very mindful of other people's experiences. And yeah, we would argue that, oh, you know, that's what a role for a kiddo, you know, what a role to step into. And yes, right, there is a skill set there that we could see as positive, something that he could take with him into life. He's aware. I mean, we all have these skill sets, right, that we acquire. But yes, right, it can either, as we see, either repeat in our adult relationships. We can also oppose the skill set. So for example, if you were an emotional caretaker to a parent who was struggling with their mental health, let's say, and you were there to cheer mom up and, you know, be by her side, and you were there to make sure that she was happy and that she was okay. And then you grow up and you get to a place where you're like, I don't want to deal with anybody's stuff. Right. Yeah. I swing the pendulum all the way in the opposite direction because I don't want to care for your emotional reactivity or your emotional sort of way of existing in the world. Right. I don't want to be responsible for that because I'm tapped out from the role that I embodied as a kiddo. Right. So we can often see people go into the repetition of a role or into the opposition of a role. And more specifically to your question, can it ever get to a place, right, where it becomes, in this instance, maybe more controlling, jealous, and absolutely, right? We want, and that's why we do this work actually, is to sort of resolve that which is unresolved from the past, so that our past isn't driving our behavior, whether it objectively looks good to the outside world or not. Because that's the thing that's a little bit tricky, is that sometimes the behavior is like, oh, how nice, you're so mindful. Oh, you're so thoughtful. Right. Oh, you do this emotional caretaking. Like, that's lovely, but it's actually not, right? And so that's the beautiful work that we do with origin healing work.
Yeah. And as you're talking, I recently watched the Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary on Netflix that was fascinating. Yeah. And one thing he said, did you see it?
I haven't seen it yet.
There's so many layers in there. But one of the things that he said was that his dad was kind of a violent guy. And he said the very thing that made me who I am and so successful is the very thing that destroyed my brother. So it's like fascinating that two siblings can have such a different reaction from possibly the same origin wound.
Totally. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely, right? It's like the path that we take in terms of the survival, right? And, you know, again, if Arnold were sitting with us, we could really open, please come on it. We could open up that dialogue. And, you know, I imagine maybe, I don't know what the level of awareness is, right? But it's like, you know, the motivation for the success, the motivation to get to the level of achievement. And obviously he's achieved a lot, you know, in this lifetime. We can all see that. But right, it's like, are we being motivated by our pain? Right. And like, I cannot be anything like this. How many people have ever said, like, I will never be like you when I grow up? right? So many people have said that. And, you know, that is an inspiration. It's motivation. It drives us. It is a driving force in our lives. And it's not to say that that's a bad thing. It's just to say that at some point in our adult lives, we have to move from being driven by the pain and being motivated by our healing. We don't lose our edge just because we heal. That is something that so many people struggle with, this idea that if I heal this thing, if I resolve this thing from the past, then all of a sudden the edge that I hold in life, right? My work ethic, my determination, my drive, you know, the thing that sets me apart, I'm going to lose that. Mm. You're not going to lose that. And so again, you know, is Arnold, we brought Arnold into a conversation.
Just Arnold's Arnold our best being, friend now. Yeah.
Arnold is our bestie. Is Arnold driven, you know, still by his pain, or is he driven by his healing? I would want to know that.
Very good question. It's a fascinating documentary. I need to rewatch it because there's so many things he said. I was like, I need to process that again. But I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about specifically partner selection, which is, you know, the very beginning stages of relationships, which I think that many people get wrong. And one of my friends said this a long time ago. I've never forgotten it. She said that most of us, when we're thinking about selecting a partner, we're looking at a list of items, and this person may look amazing on paper, but what we fail to do is put them, those attributes, in context with our own. Like, how will this person fit with me? Because sometimes it's the quote unquote perfect person, but then with you, it doesn't mesh. So is that a good way to evaluate a partner, or is it something else that you advise people on?
Well, and also, I mean, what does it mean for us to mesh as well? Like, based on what is on the paper, you know, I think that that can be a tricky, I think lists are hard.
Yeah.
In fact, I generally try to encourage people to kind of move away from, okay, you know, you've got to be, especially with, you know, appearance stuff, you know, obviously you want to feel attracted to a person, but a lot of times our lists limit so much. And then you get to the bottom of the list and you're like, there are 17 people left on the planet for you to like possibly mate with, you know, you're like, okay, we gotta open this up. And that's not about lowering your standards, but I think there's something in realizing that, like, we often create a lot of limitations for ourselves when we're like, you could literally only have this career. I will only date you if you have this career. And also, whatever those limitations are, I think actually highlight a lot of things for us. What are we looking for safety in? So if you're like, I need a partner who makes X amount of dollars, oh, then I want to learn about your relationship with money. I want to learn about your relationship with scarcity. I want to learn what safety or the lack of safety around finances was for you growing up, right? It opens up so much for us to explore when we have such specific things that we're like, unless they're this or unless they're that, I definitely will not date them. So I think there's some beauty to the flexibility. But, you know, the reality of it is that we partner with people, and I'm not talking about going on dates with people. I'm talking about once you're like, yes, I'm in, right? We are committed in this relationship together. Because you could be attracted to all loads of people and go on a number of first dates, second dates, third dates. But until you're actually choosing this partner, once that happens, what is often playing out in that space is we're going to be mirroring things back to each other. We're going to be playing out a lot of these origin wounds together, right? We serve as teachers, we serve as mirrors in relationship when we partner. And so when we're selecting people, I think one of the unconscious things that we're doing is we're checking to see if we can heal together. Right? And we don't know it exactly, but it's like, okay, if you come back to those five origin wounds, am I going to feel worthy with you? Or is that going to be in question? Am I going to feel a sense of belonging? Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. Is it bad if two people with the same type of origin wound end up together? No.
No, No, it's not good or bad or right or wrong, right? It's sort of just like, okay, we're coming together and we're here. And it's about our level of self-awareness, our level of relational awareness, right? Like, what do I know about my internal world? What do you know about your internal world? Hopefully, eventually, as we getting to know one another, what do we know about each other's internal worlds? And then this commitment, right, to creating an experience of healing with each other, meaning like, that is not something that is put into question, or when it is, we're able to have a conversation about it in order to get to a place of repair. I'm not talking about living in a vacuum. Of course, yeah. There's going to be times, you know, an insecurity, a fear pops in, we question something, we don't feel like we can be as fully expressed as we'd like to. Okay, but can I share that with you? And can we work our way to a place of safety, security, repair together? And so what I see is that, you know, couples are often, you know, pressing on each other's raw spots. You know, it's like, oh, this thing, it presents, you know, in a familiar way. It doesn't mean that it presents apples to apples, like you're exactly like my father was, or right. You're exactly like my mother was, but it presents in a way that feels familiar to our system, the way that our system codes it, right? The way that it experiences it, right? Is that the internalization of like, all of a sudden I'm feeling deprioritized in this relationship again. So when it comes to selection, you know, I think so much of what is happening there is, can I heal with you or can I not, right? Because we're going to activate stuff for each other no matter what relationship we're in. You're the healthiest of relationships. It's still there, right? You're going to activate each other, but it's whether or not you're able to walk together to a place of repair and healing, or whether it's just a relationship that continues to rupture and reignite the pain and the wounds over and over and over again.
Fascinating. I don't watch a lot of reality TV, but when I do, it's things like Love is Blind and The Bachelor. And it's those connections and relationships, it's so clear who is kind of like that and who is just completely toxic, just activates each other all the time. I wanted to ask you, so in 2020, my husband and I got married mid-pandemic, and for some reason in my head I had it that once you get married, like everything changes. That's what people tell you. But then you realize, okay, you're married now. Your conflict resolution strategies are the same. Your outlook on life is the same. Most of the fundamentals that you have are the same. You know, maybe the level of commitment obviously has changed now, but pretty much like you're not going to become a different person from today than you were yesterday if you don't do anything to work on it. So I'm curious how you see, these big life events like marriage, moving in together, having kids, affecting couples in what ways?
Yeah. Well, you think about the narratives, right? It's like everything changes and you get these negative narratives around, you know, some of these big life transitions. And it's almost like how people like heckle each other, you know,
just wait until,
right. Just wait. Are you sure it's the last person you ever want to be, you know, whatever, right. It's like those things come in left and right. But there are transitions, because I think that when you are moving in together, maybe when you are having, I know you have two children, you have your first child, you have your second child, transitions are expansive, and they also invite in grief. Always, no matter how objectively good something might be, where you're like, yes, I'm so excited to, you know, become a mother, or yes, I'm so excited to marry this person, or yes, I'm so excited to move in and, you know, bring our lives together. Right? These things can, what we call the both and, right? These dialectical experiences where I can be excited and joyful and also nervous, afraid, grieving something. There's former versions of our lives that are different than what these transitions are bringing us to. We often talk about the loss of freedom when we are moving into some of these big transitions. Mm-hmm. I remember when I moved in with my now husband, and I had lived alone. I lived with some girlfriends in, you know, in university, but then after that I had lived alone. And I remember when we moved in, and this is a common thing that I hear from so many people, friends, clients of mine, like where you're like, wait, I like, there's nowhere to go. Like,
yeah,
there's nowhere to exit. You know, what do you mean? And I'm an only child too. So I think that plays into it a little bit more, where I was so comfortable and so good at being, you know, in my alone and having my own space and my privacy and all of that. And, you know, that shift was significant. I think, I don't know if I felt it as much with marriage. I also have a child, I have a 3-year-old, and, you know, that loss of freedom, and it's the both and, right? There were beautiful, beautiful things about it, becoming a mom, having this sweet angel in my life. And also, oh my gosh, right? Like the life and the world that I knew before he had arrived was totally, totally different. And so I like to think about transitions whenever I talk about them, is like to see where there is the expansion and the growth that is happening, but to also honor the grief that is presenting. And I think sometimes when we reject the grief because we're like, but I'm getting married, I should be happy, but I'm having a child, I should be happy, right? Like we sort of force this idea, right? It's like, then we're really disconnecting from the full expanse, you know, of the experience, right? Which is that it's multidimensional, and it has, you know, lots of feelings that almost feel like they contradict one another, but that there is, that is such a universal experience, right? That we are allowed to feel both joy and fear, that I'm allowed to, you know, experience excitement and loss simultaneously. And so I think, you know, this practice of honoring, you know, what is there is such an important experience. And it also is the work of origin work, because so many people are like, well, but my parents did the best that they could, or they had a hard childhood themselves, or they did such a better job than their parents did to them. Or, right? Like the list goes on. I don't want to be ungrateful. They sacrificed so much, right? And so there's so much there. And it's like, yes, and, right? The yes and is so vital in all of this work, whether we're talking about transitions, whether we're talking about our origin wounds, right? It's like to make space to say that might be true, and you also had an experience that wants to be acknowledged and honored. And acknowledging and honoring your experience is not synonymous with hating them, being ungrateful, throwing them under the bus, not honoring or seeing or holding the context of their stories. We can do that, and we can honor our own. And that's the same with transitions, right? It's like, ah, the beauty of it and also the loss that's presenting. And so we have to, as humans, I think, get better at honoring the both and. Yes, and, okay, come back to that as much as we can.
It's all about nuance. I just mentioned this in another interview I did, but when I was writing for Fortune, I turned in this article, and my editor immediately sent it back to me and was like, "Whoa, like call me." And I was like, "What? This is my best work." I call him, and he's like, "It's interesting because your writing is very sloppy in that you write in very absolute terms. You say this person always felt like this, or the entire firm hated the snacks or something like that." And it's like, that's false because there's so much nuance and context that you're missing. And he used it as an opportunity to kind of teach me a bigger lesson, which was, if you're writing like this, this means that you're probably thinking about the world like this. And it's like it taught me to look for the details and kind of the what underlies some of these big things where we want to post on Instagram and say, oh, it's all amazing having kids, but I just ate my salad in the bathroom, so I didn't have to wake up the baby, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I think there's something, you know, and it's just so much more relatable. We really want to be able to bring that human experience forward. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there is somebody out there who finds, you know, being a parent amazing 100% of the time. God bless you, you know, wherever you are, right? But, you know, I think there's something so beautiful, right, about sort of being in the nooks and crannies of life, and to know that it all changes, right? Like that the, you know, that if we are in a place where things are feeling really good, right, that like guess what? That's going to come to an end at some point. And so is when things are feeling really bad. And, right. you know, this play, we're sort of on this cycle, right? Where it's like connection, rupture, repair, connection, rupture, repair, right? And we go around and around and around. And obviously we'd love to hang out in connection as much as possible.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we just like be in connection all the time?
Yeah, we could be in connection a lot of the time. Yeah. I think the relationship with repair is one of the most underrated things.
I wanted to ask
talk about
that,
it
actually.
Enough, yeah. right? Is like repair is so important because when we race to repair, when we learn, okay, it's time to repair, right? Then we can move out of disconnection, you know, much faster. And it's, we're never going to live a life without disconnection. We're never going to live a life without, you know, feeling let down sometimes, feeling hurt, feeling disappointed, feeling betrayed, right? Like, of course, we want to limit that as much as possible, but it's not possible to live a life that abstains from that.
Yeah.
And so when we present our lives that way, or we think it should be that way only, right? I think we're shortchanging ourselves because there's so much beauty actually to learning how to navigate ruptures well and mm-hmm. learn how to navigate getting through a hard thing together, whether we're talking about romantic relationships, partnerships, whether we're talking about navigating hard moments with our children, our friendships, et cetera, right? All of those relationships are so important, and it's so vital that we learn how to repair well together. It's the basis of attachment, you know, is getting yeah. through hard things together. Not, we never had a hard thing, thank gosh, right? It's like, no, we get through hard things together. And that's one of the things, you know, for many of us, we might not have been taught that in our families, right? We might not have learned that you could get out through a hard thing, that when you mess up, you get the silent treatment, or you're punished this way, or you get screamed at or ridiculed, or somebody, you know, like for me, I got the silent treatment from my dad. I would, he would not speak to me for days or weeks on end.
Wow.
And you know, I learned, right? Like, okay, if I am the good, quote unquote, good girl, then I have connectivity and I have love and I have presence and I have help and I have support. But when I am, quote unquote, problematic, you know, whatever that meant as a teenager, was always within reason when I look at it, but problematic, pushing back on boundaries, something like that, then my connection to love and attachment and presence, right, was cut. It was cut. Mm-hmm. It was gone. Yeah. Right. And so you look at that and you're like, ooh, I didn't learn in that relationship how to get through hard things. He didn't have the capacity at the time. He didn't have the emotional maturity at the time to get through a hard thing with me as a kiddo. So when we look again at like, okay, how did I grow up? What were the systems around me? What was taught there? And then we think about fast forwarding and we're like, okay, I'm in my adult life right now. You know, what does it look
yeah.
like? Right. That's such a huge part of, you know, navigating relationships in a healthy way.
It's so interesting because if you do think about it, for example, I also grew up as an only child. So I didn't have siblings or friends close enough where we would argue all the time and then repair. So I guess, I don't know. I just assume that if you don't fight, that's a good relationship. Whereas my husband grew up with, there were five brothers. So they would fight all wow. the time, but then they would repair also very quickly. So it's like when you have two people coming together, thinking about repair so differently, it's like, you know, how do you get there? So after we got married, I asked the readers of my newsletter for relationship advice. I did not know, well, of course, a lot of people had opinions, but I didn't realize that the things that were most interesting to me actually didn't come from the people whose marriages, you know, had succeeded. It was the people who were on their second marriages and they already had one failed, that they learned all the lessons from that and are now applying it a second time. And one of the lessons that I took away was that repair is much, much more important than whatever the fight is about. So you just mentioned how it's so important, but do you have any specific strategies of how we can race to repair and not linger in the rupture zone?
Mm. Yeah, the rupture zone is tough, right? Because most of us are in a self-protective place, right? There's a rupture, somebody said something, somebody did something, we're insulted, we're hurt, we're betrayed, we're let down, we're disappointed, okay, whatever it is that's going on. When that's happening, the majority of us go into place of needing to protect. protect ourselves, which means maybe I shut down, maybe I become defensive, maybe I become critical of you, maybe I prove my point, maybe I make sure that you see how wrong, bad, terrible you were, right? Whatever it might be. And for anybody listening, right, to gently even identify, you know, I was a point prover. I was a very good point prover. Now, when we understand, okay, my behavior in the rupture is trying to protect me from something. Good. Let's have a little bit of compassion for that. Now, we can't let that behavior stick around forever because it's destructive, right? If I'm proving my point all the time, it's not going to get us very far. If you're being defensive all the time, it's not going to get us very far. But when we understand that it's self-protective, right, that's something that we can have more compassion and grace for. I'll share a quick story.
Yeah.
Grew up, my family, as you know, I'm only child. My parents went through a very hard divorce. It was a long process, 9 years. And there was a lot of gaslighting, manipulation, psychological abuse, paranoia, emotional flooding. It was super chaotic. It was really bad. And little girl watching this, I'm the observer. My dad at the time was very manipulative, gaslighter. He was very quick with his words and he could change it on a dime. And my mom, she was not able to keep up with it. She could not follow. She was paranoid. She was just like taken over by it. As a little girl, I looked at those two things and I said, okay, you know, being right, because my dad was always right. He could always sort of masterfully create scenarios in which he was always right. Being right meant safety. Okay. Mm. Being wrong meant no safety. Okay. I saw what it did to her. I saw the position that he was in. Fast forward, I'm in an argument with my husband, before we were married, and I don't know what it was about, but we're arguing.
Isn't that funny how you never remember what it was about, but you remember the actual argument? Yeah.
I was doubling down, tripling down, proving my point, needing to be right over and over and over again. And I brought in curiosity. Instead of, you know, there was a little bit of shame there first, but I brought in curiosity to say, okay, what is the behavior serving? What is it trying to protect me from? And I realized, like, all right, when I go back into my childhood, I see that my need to be right is actually just a protective strategy, right? Mm-hmm. The protective strategy, though, for the self is going to delay repair. Right? Hmm. It's always going to delay repair because I'm needing to protect me as opposed to protecting the relationship, meaning I'm still part of the relationship, but I have to protect me sort of at the expense of you, right? We're going into like our prefrontal cortex is not online. Like we're not able to reason, right? We're our nervous system is in this space, right? Where it's having to self-protect. And so when we think about like, how do we do repair better? We always have to get to a place of safety first, right? Our nervous systems really need to be regulated. When they're dysregulated, it's very hard to get there. So that's why people take timeouts. That's why people take breathers. That's why I go for a walk. That's why we, you know, we sort of like try to reflect on what's happening here. But the reality of it is that the more that we know about ourselves, our defense mechanisms, our protective strategies, our histories, then the more that we can actually sort of prepare for these moments and understand what might happen there too. That's why I always say, like, you need to know your own family of origin, your origin wounds. You need to know that for your partner as well. Or you have to be able to have these open conversations and dialogues so that you can move through these moments of, you know, rupture and repair much better. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, right, it's like our nervous system needs to be regulated. Okay. We have to move our systems into a place of safety, which can look a lot of different ways for loads of different people. And we have to understand our origin wounds and the wounds of our partner, right? Like, what is that person trying to protect in this moment too? Because I think that offers us compassion and grace for them as well, right? When we can see our partners as kiddos in a complicated family system, as opposed to like this adult who's just battling me or can't listen or can't see or whatever, you know, it's like whatever story we might be telling in that moment. It's hard work. One of the things that I would recommend is not trying to learn this and do this in the moment, but when we're not heated, when we're not activated, when our nervous systems are regulated, to talk about, okay, what happens when we're ruptured? right? Like what actually happens? What do I do to self-protect? And what do you do to self-protect? And do we understand what's familiar about that or why our systems go to that place? What data is our system scanning for that's like, I know this moment because historically we've had experiences that are similar, familiar to this, and I'm needing to protect myself, right? Our bodies will protect us from mm-hmm. things that they code as a threat. And so we don't always know that it's not a threat in this moment, even though it's a different person. You hear people say, I'm not your father. I'm not your mother. I'm not your ex. It doesn't matter in this. You can't, it's irrelevant. It has mm-hmm. nothing to do because that's not how the system processes it. It doesn't, it's not sitting there rationally thinking, oh, you're a different person. It's scanning for familiarity. It's saying, oh, we think that we're in the same situation and we're going to do what we did before in order to protect ourselves. So it's a big answer, but, and there's a lot to do, and it's not a like follow these three steps and you'll get to repair, but it is something that takes practice and work and we can begin somewhere.
So in you mentioned one of maybe a strategy to de-escalate the conflict is, hey, let me take a moment, step away, even though that might activate the other person's anxiety, but that's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. But what are some other strategies to de-escalate conflict? Like could well-timed humor help? Like what are some things?
It can, you know, every relationship obviously is so unique. So for somebody, well-timed humor might totally de-escalate it. And for someone else, it might rev the engine. Like how dare you, right? So I think there's something actually to each person.
Yeah.
What are the things that kind of like pull the plug out? Cause you're right. So for some people, like taking a walk is something that feels incredibly threatening to the other person. Let's mm-hmm. say they have an abandonment issue, right? They feel like you're leaving in a moment. Of course, everybody mm-hmm. does this to me, right? And so we need to know the unique sort of experiences of each person that's there. But I think sometimes like having the agreed upon diffuser ahead of time is really helpful. So do we have a code word, right? Some couples will have a code word that's agreed upon where they're like, we've lost it. There's no coming back from this right now. So when we say this word, we agree, we accept, we know that we're going to come back to it eventually. And a lot of times for people who have abandonment trouble, right? It's like, I'm coming back. We need a break. I am not leaving you. I'm not abandoning you. I'm coming back to this conversation, but we cannot have it right now. Right. So it's like you almost put a balm on it, knowing that this could feel activating. For other people, like actually coming back into breath, again, nervous system regulation is like, let's stop. Let's breathe together. Or I can't stand you, so I'm going to go over here and breathe by myself. You know? It could be the way it's like you, but figuring out like, okay, I'm going to breathe. I'm going to come back into my body. I'm going to do a meditation, right? Like there's so many things that can just sort of chop it up. But I would say timeouts, code words, nature. If you have the opportunity to step outside, mm-hmm. go for a walk, even maybe you both step outside together, but you go in different directions, right? And you just take a walk, you come back into your breath, you move your body, you do a meditation, you journal. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different techniques that we can use in those moments.
So it's about getting yourself regulated again. Yeah.
You cannot heal when you're not regulated. It just is, you cannot, right? And so it is so vital that we bring ourselves back into regulation. When we're heated though, you know, there's tools like a couple, you can sync up your breath together. If you like arms around each other's rib cages and the person with the bigger rib cage is going to follow the breath of the person with the smaller rib cage, you're going to go head forehead to forehead and just like rest there. Now for some people in that moment, they're like, get out of here. I don't even want to be touched by you, you know, but it, so it's all sort of figuring out where you are in the rupture is some, what's available to you in this moment. What is going to be the thing that is most soothing for you and regulating for you? Maybe it's a song that you listen to. Maybe you go take a shower, you get into the bath, you put a scent on you. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've listed like 10 things now. Yeah. But yes, my main point is getting each person to really get curious about the thing that helps support them in their nervous system regulation the most, and coming back to that over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's a really good point. To basically, every relationship is unique. So spend the time with your partner to tell them, hey, this is what would diffuse the conflict in this situation. Mm-hmm. Let's do that next time, instead of trying to figure it out in the moment. In your book,
I've heard people have you ever heard people try to whisper when they're fighting?
I've never
done it, but I'm just, when you said the humor, like cutting it with humor, you know, I've heard people where they're like, we go into a space where you have to whisper while you fight. And you're like,
that's interesting.
You know, and again, there is something humorous about it, but yes. I think it's like, it's the timing. Is it the right place, you know, to do something like that? It's not something that I have actually ever recommended before, but I was just thinking about, you know, like cutting it with humor and, you know, allowing it for me, it to be a, you know, a funnier moment. If that's available to you.
The best one I've heard is Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, and her husband, Jesse Itzler. Apparently, when they're in like the heat of the moment of a fight, he'll like extend his hand and they'll slow dance. And she's like, and then after that, it's hard to continue the argument. So it's like something small that, you know, whether it's that or you have an agreement, I will always, you know, take your hand if you reach out or something like that, I think could be interesting.
It's a great example.
In your book, you have an entire chapter on conflict. But the thing that I appreciated and learned is that it's not one big blowout fight that will end the entire relationship or the entire marriage, because it's not always as cut and dry as, okay, he cheated on me, I'm going to leave the relationship. A lot of times it's just like moments of disrespect in various ways that chip away at the relationship. So, you know, how many relationships fail because of this continuous degrading of the relationship? And what are ways that on a daily basis we can put in more effort to prevent that degradation?
Depending on how you define fail, you know, if you're looking at metrics like end in divorce or the relationship itself just ends, you know, many states together. If we're thinking fail in that this is no longer a healthy, productive, you know, evolving relationship, then all like the degradation of a relationship is deeply impactful. The stripping away of respect and admiration and gratitude, right? It's like that's core, a principle to all relationships. And so, yeah, I mean, you're pointing to the small, the things done over and over and over again. Obviously, we have big ruptures, and sometimes big ruptures do end a relationship. But I would say that more times than not, they don't. And oftentimes, even when there is a big rupture, there's also mini ruptures that are leading up to that as well. But yes, I mean, I think for me, I always say like resentment is such a relationship killer. And what gets us to a place of resentment?
And what is resentment? Like what does that constitute?
Well, I think when we're losing respect or we feel a loss of respect from a partner, when there's not enough appreciation and gratitude, and I don't mean inauthentic appreciation and gratitude, right? Like you don't need to go, thank you so much. I so appreciate everything you raised. Like that falls on deaf ears, right? That doesn't work. But right, like a heartfelt appreciation, a heartfelt acknowledgement of each other as human beings who are doing so much and contributing so much to life and the relationship and the family or whatever the scenario might be. And so the resentment will happen when there is a mismatch in those things, right? Mm-hmm. Where you are doing a lot, but you don't feel acknowledged for it. Or when you feel like, okay, I'm doing more than you, whether that is true or not, right? That might be argued, but it gets to this place. You think about these transitions again, right? Like how many couples start to experience and express resentments post-child, I'm doing this, that, and this, that, this, that. The other person's sitting over here saying, I'm doing this, that, this, that, this, that, right? And it's like these two people who are putting a lot of energy into different areas a lot of the time, but not feeling seen, acknowledged, heard, understood, appreciated for the contributions, even though those contributions are different from one another. So yeah, the degradation of relationship, you know, we get comfortable with each other. You've ever seen those quotes where it's like, if you treat each other like the, you know, the same way that you treated each other in the beginning of the relationship, there will never be an end. And although those types of quotes are like, they irk me.
Yeah.
A bit. You know, there is something to, we're very good generally at acknowledging and appreciating each other at the beginning of relationships. And I think sometimes we lose because we get very comfortable or we have these expectations or, you know, the operation at home, you know, works a certain way. And we, you know, we don't appreciate it anymore. Right. It's just like the unspoken, the given. And again, no, I am not suggesting like, hey, thank you so much for taking out the garbage. Like I couldn't live life without you. It's like, we don't need to slide to that extreme, but are we actually acknowledging each other? Are we seeing each other, right? Like, are you seeing your partner and is your partner seeing you? And can you come back into a place of appreciating what each contributes to the operation of the relationship? Right? We have to continue to build up. And of course, there's going to be waves. Of course, it's going to ebb and flow. I don't expect people to stay, you know, in that top space all of the time, but we want to keep trying to build to that place of appreciation, gratitude, respect, admiration for one another.
Are those the patterns, respect, admiration, and gratitude, are those the patterns that you see in the healthiest couples? Like you always hear of those couples that have been together for decades on end and still so in love. Like, what do they have? Like, what are the patterns that they exhibit?
Well, I think there's a deep understanding of each other's internal worlds, meaning like what is what's happening inside. I know you in a really deep way. I don't like, if I were to ask you, like, what is your partner struggling with right now? What is your partner feeling most excited and grateful for? What's he most inspired by? What's she most inspired by? Who has she felt the closest to at this point in her life right now? Which friend of hers? What fear does she have right now? Where is she feeling most insecure? Where is he feeling most insecure? Can you answer those questions? Do they come to you like this, or you're like, shit, I don't know any of those answers. Like I could take a stab, but I'm not sure because we haven't talked about it. I don't know. Like, I don't really know what's happening in your world, right? So a deep understanding of each other's internal worlds is so important. We talk about low negativity thresholds in relationships. This talks about how we're communicating with each other, meaning when there is something we experience as quote unquote negative. A lot of times people will like let it build or they brush it off their shoulders or they don't make a, you know, mountain out of a molehill, right? Those types of things. And so they sort of avoid or they push it as opposed to addressing it sooner. And what we see is that healthier couples actually address it faster. The threshold for how much negative they're willing to tolerate is really low, as opposed to tolerating a lot of negative, whatever negative means to you. Okay.
But isn't there a danger of, you know, every little thing I'm talking to them about, and then it becomes this like string of negativity?
Yes, but this is where your nuanced mind comes into the conversation, which is, no, this isn't like, I can't stand that blue color that you're wearing, right? Or nitpicking little things, right? It's about things that have an impact on you, you know, and like things that actually, and again, obviously this is so subjective, like how each individual might define this and really experience it. But yes, there's a risk of I'm going to nitpick everything. I'm going to find problems constantly. If that's what's happening, that's a different issue. But for, you know, other couples, right, getting to a place where, ooh, like that really hurt my feelings actually, or like, oh, I didn't appreciate that at all. And I'm going to share that with you because I don't want to harbor it. I don't want to hold it inside of my body. I don't want to store it because what do we talk about before? Ooh, leads to resentment, right? And so we want to clear out and move those things out. But I was smiling before when you said that, like what, you know, these couples who make it to the end and are so happy. I posted something on Instagram not too long ago where I was talking about, you know, you have people interview elderly couples that they see together and they're like, what's the secret sauce?
Yeah.
Like, how did you get here? You know, tell us all the things. And like a lot of times they say really cute things. You're like, oh, that's sweet. And I heard a couple once say, we didn't want to get divorced at the same time. And I loved that answer because, you know, it wasn't like the sweet, cute answer, but there was something about this concept of knowing and accepting that at different points in the relationship, one of us is going to lead a little bit more than the other. Sometimes one of us is going to have a foot out or we're going to be like, what on earth is happening? Or like, I don't feel super motivated or invested in the relationship, but the other person is holding possibility. They're able to like see the way through, even when the other person might be struggling to see the way through. And obviously, the hope would be that we don't enter into this place that often. And it's, you know, the cadence of it is not, you know, frequent, but that, yeah, like the inevitability of hardship in life, right? The inevitability of, you know, these major transitions that we go through that sometimes have us questioning like, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. And if you have one person who can see the path through, which I find with couples actually, right, is
yeah.
Like you might have one person struggling, but the other one is like, I'm here. You know, the feet are planted. I'm here. I got us. Whether they say that language or not, I am here. I got us. I'm in. And they hold the space until the other person can come back. And sometimes that role reverses, right? It's like sort of equal by the end of a lifetime. And so I loved that answer. And I think there's so much truth to sort of honoring the ebbs and flows of life and the, you know, inevitability of hitting rough patches along the way. But that if one person can hold possibility and see the sight line, that we have a pretty good chance of finding a way through.
That's a really great answer. I've never thought about it like that. Okay, this is more of a question about just therapy in general. And I've always wanted to ask someone, but it feels like these days, like a lot of the people that I know are in individual therapy or couples therapy or whatever it may be. But, you know, a big thought is how do you measure success? Because it could go either way, but how do you measure success of a session or of the therapy in general? Mm-hmm. Do you ever tell couples, hey, I think you're good. Like you don't need this anymore.
Yeah, there's definitely times where, you know, we get to a point in the work where they've met their goals and it almost is like there's not a whole lot in this chapter to accomplish. And that doesn't mean that a next chapter is not going to spark something for us. It might, but yeah, absolutely. There are times where we get to a place where goals have been met and, you know, it's like, as they say, it's time for you to go spread your wings out of the real world and, you know, like really use the tools and the growth and the evolution and the healing that you've had and that you actually don't need this space anymore in order to meet what you came here for. You've met it. Now, I'm a big believer that our healing and our growth, like kind of, it just doesn't end, right? In different chapters, we get to different stages of life. Different stages of life present different things to us. You know, I'm going to have things confronted in my life that I haven't experienced or thought about, you know, 40 years from now. Right? Mm-hmm. What's it going to be like to, you know, be losing my friends? What's it going to be like to face mortality? What's it going to be like? You know, it's like, there's so many things that will present at different points of life. And I think that's the beauty of it is that when we're confronted, we're willing and open to address it. And that it's also beautiful to step away from something and just like live and exist with the tools and the growth that we have, you know, achieved and, you know, logged and put in our back pockets.
That's fascinating. And my final question is very quick, but what's one super specific practical thing that we can do today to make our relationships instantly better?
I would say to think about one thing that you have not acknowledged that you would like to acknowledge in your partner. Okay. Mm. Or whatever, your child or your parent or your friend, whatever relationship we're talking about here, but to look for something that you have not acknowledged that you can acknowledge. And really brave question, often reserved more, but it could be for any relationship, but I often ask this to my couples. Brave, brave, brave question. What's it like to be in relationship with me right now? Oy. Mm-hmm. Big oof, right? What is it like to be in relationship with me right now? And what could I be doing differently for this relationship to align more for you?
Love that. That
is very willing to hear the answer.
That is very brave, Yetta.
Yes. It is.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. This was a really, really fascinating conversation. I think people will find a lot of practical action items from it.
Great. Thanks for having me.